I do wish that Roger was well enough to be with us this morning, but it's also a great honor for me to share his words with you today. He begins from his own personal experience. During my year of working as a chaplain at a drug and alcohol treatment center, I noticed that just about everyone had two things in common. They had significant unresolved grief issues, and they battled in one way or another with perfectionism. Addiction is an attempt at self-medication, so for many folks at the treatment center, alcoholism and drug addiction were how they tried to cope with grief and the sense that they were falling short of their expectations for themselves. Addiction was their desperate attempt to deal with the grief and to silence a relentless inner critic. Addiction was an attempt to control these demons. Sometimes it actually worked, for a while anyway. The self-medication allowed them to live in denial of the grief and feelings of failure. But even when this happened, the addiction itself caused so much other damage that their lives became unmanageable. It wrecked their relationships, their bodies, their minds, their ability to function at work. And of course, the grief and the feelings of failure didn't actually go away when they were using. They just went underground for a while. More often than not, this going underground only added to the potency of the unresolved grief and feelings of inadequacy. Acknowledging and then actually dealing with these parts of their lives felt even more dangerous. And so they drank more or used drugs more. Roger remembers Ron W. Outwardly, he had all the trappings of success, a handsome, athletic body, nice clothes, a family that appeared happy, a highly successful medical practice. His medical skills were widely admired. Sometimes it seemed like he went out of his way to trumpet and prove his greatness as a doctor. He also used his office to get narcotics for himself. The narcotics were beginning to take an increasingly obvious toll on his life. Insomnia, frayed relationships at home, small mistakes in his work, and most recently a DWI charge after he had mixed drugs with booze and then gotten behind the wheel. He felt like his illegal prescription writing would soon be discovered. He kind of hoped that it would be. The worse he felt, and the worse the collateral damage from the addiction got, the more he used. His life had become completely unmanageable. And so he checked into the treatment center. Like any of us, Ron was facing a complicated set of issues. Among them was a nagging, relentless sense that he was a disappointment to his father. His father never had much good to say about Ron. Everything about him that came out of his dad's mouth seemed critical. Ron had worked so hard to get his father's approval. And then his father had died suddenly a few years ago. And Ron realized that he would never be able to get that approval. But this didn't keep him from trying. He kept hearing a voice of disapproval in the back of his mind, and it was his dad's voice. The drug seemed the best way to silence the voice. His arrogance was another vehicle that he used to try to quiet that voice of disapproval. Michelle S. was one of the most rugged survivors Roger had ever met. She had survived repeated sexual assault by her stepdad, and then the betrayal of having her mom deny these crimes. She had survived a descent into the world of hard drugs and using her body to get drugs. She had survived the challenges of trying to raise a child as a single mom with a low-income service industry job. A high school dropout, she had clawed her way to a GED and then enrolled in a community college. A recent relapse threatened everything she was building in her life. Like a lot of survivors of abuse, Michelle felt a great deal of shame and guilt about what had happened to her, even though she knew intellectually that it wasn't her fault. She didn't feel like a rugged survivor on the inside. She felt like a failure, a screw-up, a weak person. Getting high was the only way she had found to turn off those feelings of failure and shame and guilt. Finding a healthy way to deal with these feelings was task number one in her recovery. Ron and Michelle weren't struggling with anything unique to them. Feeling imperfect is a basic human condition. This is because imperfection is the nature of all life on this planet. That's what Annie Dillard was pointing out in the reading. We are all frayed and nibbled survivors. Not just on the outside where our bodies show the scars of living, but on the inside too. We suffer horrendous losses. We fail often, sometimes spectacularly, sometimes publicly. We inflict wounds on others. There is a crack in everything God has made, Emerson observed, and that includes us. Everything is frayed and nibbled. Every human life has at least one tragic element. This is why ancient Greek drama still speaks to us all these millennia later. So how can we deal constructively with our inherent imperfection? Given that our inherent imperfection is one of the things that fuels addiction, a great place to look for wisdom is the 12 steps. Dealing with imperfection constructively, rather than destructively, is one of the many nuggets of wisdom in 12-step spirituality. The first step of AA, that's Alcoholics Anonymous, is admitting powerlessness over alcohol, is acknowledging that the addiction has made life unmanageable. This cuts through the alcoholic's denial. It's admitting that all the efforts to manage the addiction have failed and will always fail. I think there's another reason this admission is so powerful. It names a truth about life. There are things, a lot of things actually, in every human life that we cannot control. Where we are born, for example, who our parents are, what our unique mix of genes is. Ron couldn't ever make his dad approve of him, especially now that his father was gone. Michelle couldn't ever make the abuse she suffered disappear from her past, no matter what she did. It wasn't just the drugs and alcohol that they couldn't control. There was a lot of other things. This is the human condition. We can't control it all. But that doesn't mean that we are completely powerless over everything either. If AA taught that, the first step would be a dead end. In fact, we all have agency in our lives. Yet this agency does have limits. Part of the wisdom of the 12 steps is helping people figure out what in our lives we don't have control over and what in our lives we might, with the help of others and a higher power, have some control over. Tweaking the Serenity Prayer slightly gets at this truth. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot control, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The second and third steps of the 12 steps are about surrender. In the second step, we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. In the third step, we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to this higher power. Part of the wisdom of 12-step spirituality is that it doesn't define who or what this higher power is. It doesn't have to be a traditional anthropomorphic God. you can define and understand your higher power in whatever way fits your unique spirituality. The bottom line is that there is something greater than you, than me, than all of us. Roger writes, "Even though I'm agnostic and therefore unsure about the existence of God, I believe with every cell in my body that there is something in this universe greater than I am. If I didn't believe this, I'd be more tempted to think that I can solve everything on my own. I would be more tempted to think that I have the capacity to make myself perfect or nearly perfect all by myself. And then I would feel bad when I inevitably fell short of these high expectations. In my life, there is plenty greater than I am. Nature, love, Unitarian Universalism, the community of this fellowship, to name a few. This doesn't mean that these things are perfect. Everything in existence is frayed and nibbled, even nature, even love, even Unitarian Universalism, even this fellowship. But there's a lot more wisdom in nature, in love, in Unitarian Universalism, and in this fellowship than I could possibly find on my own. And so I surrender to this reality. It's part of what keeps me humble and open. It's part of what keeps me from expecting perfection or even near perfection from myself, and then beating myself up when I inevitably fall short. Surrender is not an easy concept for Unitarian Universalists. It's not a word that you will find anywhere in our seven principles. And yet, I believe that it's an essential spiritual concept to understand and even to embrace. We have to surrender to the reality that we don't individually have all the tools we could ever need to master everything that life dishes out at us. We must surrender to something greater than ourselves. Joan Chittister writes that surrender is the moment in which we realize that it is time to become someone new. Surrender is not about giving up. It is about moving on. So, Ron and Michelle surrendered themselves to the reality that life had become unmanageable, and they surrendered to something greater than themselves. They embraced the reality that they weren't going to beat this thing on their own. They reached out. They embraced the idea that it was time to become someone new, a clean and sober Ron, a clean and sober Michelle. The next steps in AA are all about our inherent human imperfection, too. The fourth step is doing a searching and fearless moral inventory of oneself. The fifth step is using that inventory to speak aloud and own the exact nature of our wrongs to our higher power, ourselves, and another human being. These steps are all about taking a clear-eyed, honest look at ourselves and then admitting where we screwed up. Ron's addiction had hurt himself, his family, and his patients. Somewhere inside, he knew this. This reality was another thing he had been trying to escape through drugs. He needed to admit these painful truths if he wanted to stop medicating himself with drugs. The next two steps bring the alcoholic back to powerlessness and surrender. In these steps, alcoholics admit that they can't fix themselves on their own. They humbly ask their higher power to help them work on removing these shortcomings. And then they do the really difficult work of compiling a list of those they've hurt, and where it's possible and doesn't cause greater harm, they make amends to these people. Now, the 10th step may be the most brilliant of all. It acknowledges that an alcoholic doesn't suddenly become perfect as a result of working through the first 9 steps. It doesn't work that way. The recovering alcoholic stays human, is still frayed and nibbled and imperfect. So in the 10th step, the recovering alcoholic continues to do a moral inventory on an ongoing basis and makes amends promptly whenever he or she screws up. The 12 steps provide a roadmap for dealing with our inherent human imperfection. I think it's a roadmap that can work regardless of whether you're an addict or alcoholic or not. Let me remind you here that I'm quoting Roger, since this little bit is more personal and also my own name comes up. Sounds ominous, but it's not. Roger says, I'm trying to apply the 12-step roadmap principles to my life. I've known for a long time that, like all my siblings, I am hardwired to be a perfectionist. I had confirmation of this again on Friday when Leah Hart-Landsberg and I sat down with a consultant we've hired to help us get our ministerial partnership off to a good and intentional start. As the consultant went through our personality and leadership assessments, he noted that I was on the very high end of responsibility and conscientiousness. Looks like you're a perfectionist, he observed. Yeah, that's me, said Roger. And then Roger realized, given our inherent human limitations, I'm an imperfect perfectionist. Ministry in a growing, dynamic congregation is a lousy place to be a perfectionist. For starters, there is way more to do than can possibly ever be done. The fellowship is dynamic and vibrant, and that is a constant wild card into what needs to happen. If I let it, my perfectionism could guilt me into letting the work totally and completely consume my life. I know that allowing this to happen would be a disaster for me, for my family, ultimately for my ministry, and even for this fellowship. So I fight a constant battle with the inner demon of perfectionism. I have learned to walk away from the work, but I've had less success at not letting it then gnaw away at me after I've walked away. How can 12-step wisdom help? Well, it reminds me that I'm not all powerful. I'm a failable, limited human being, just like everybody else. It reminds me that there is something greater than I am. The fellowship's fate doesn't all ride on me or on any one of us. It's not about me or about you. We're all in this together. It reminds me that I will screw up, and that's okay because I have a way to admit this and to try to make amends. It reminds me that I will have to keep working on this as long as I am alive. Knowing how deeply the perfectionism streak seems to be in me, I can well imagine I'll have to work at not being perfect, even about dying when that time comes. Yes, I will want to go through hospice with flying colors. The truth is, we are stuck with most of our issues from cradle to grave. That's a bummer. But I guess it's part of living this frayed and nibbled existence. In thinking about perfectionism this week, I've realized that maybe more than anything else, perfectionism is a manifestation of idolatry. When we expect ourselves to be perfect, we are expecting ourselves to be divine. Seeing the divine where it isn't, this is idolatry. Perfectionism, expecting ourselves to be like a god, is a potentially deadly sin. It fuels addiction. It creates chronically low self-esteem, or paradoxically, it makes us arrogant. Unmanaged, it can ruin and even end our lives. So even though I'm going to deal with my perfectionism imperfectly, I have to keep working at it. The stakes are high. I'm going to have to keep my sculpting tool in my hand and not pick up the club to smash my imperfect life over and over again, as did the novice artist in the poem in The Call to Gather. I'm going to have to keep the tool in my hand and keep on imperfectly sculpting my life. May it always be so.